Open your Bibles with you, that you have with you, to Mark 8, please. We have come to that place in our study where we're going to talk about Peter's goobers. But as a thought of introduction, I went looking to see some statistics about just how gooberish we are. So, you ready for a few of those? According to some recent statistics, the average American lies once or twice a day.
Wow.
Once or twice a day, we lie. 30 to 40% of us cheat on our taxes. Pretty high number.
That's a high number.
35% of all women have had an abortion. The percentage of marriages that have infidelity in one form or another is 41%. And this is the one that shocked me. Women who said that they would have an affair if they knew they weren't going to get caught, 68%. So before we give old Peter the old thumbs in the nose routine about goobers, we're pretty guy goobered. There is no one in this room, if we were to take the time and we were being honest, it would go around the room and say in the last 7 days, we haven't significantly disappointed our Savior. I doubt that there would be one of us that would say in the last year of our life, there hasn't been something that we have chosen to do or to think or to say or wish we had thought, did, or said that would make the rest of us proud. The truth of the matter is Peter makes two big mistakes, and we ought to look at them. We're looking at him, trying to be objective. I spent a lot of time the last week or so trying to get you to see him as something other than a stereotypical bumbler, but he most definitely has two very significant goobers. Good morning, Sheffield.
Good morning.
Just decided to wake up. All that singing and he wasn't sleeping. Let's go to Mark 8 and see the first of Peter's big mistakes. This mistake actually is found in Matthew 16, Mark 8, and Luke 9. I'm going to choose to teach it out of Mark 8, but certainly as you read or rethink this lesson, go back and look at the other places. Mark chapter 8, verse 31 and following. Just before this, the setting is that Peter has declared that Jesus is the Messiah. In verse 29, he says, "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "Hey, you are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them, that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now pause a second. The Son of Man is a phrase that Jesus likes to use for himself. Your notes will tell you that he uses it about 81 times in the New Testament. It's just one of those titles that he uses. When he begins to give them this prediction that the Son of Man, that he, Jesus, must suffer many things, be rejected, he specifies who he's going to be rejected by: the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. If you were a good Jewish woman, you would know that he's referring to the Sanhedrin, a group of Jewish leaders. There were 70 of them that were in a council at that time. They served for life. So once you got into the Sanhedrin, you didn't get bumped out. And they ruled under the Romans. The Romans gave them the right to have something to say about the spiritual or religious life of the Jews. Remember that Pontius Pilate is the Roman leader at this time. But the Jewish leaders are these council members, the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin drew or selected its 70 members from three distinct groups. First, the chief priest. And those would be the one that's ruling now. And maybe some previous ones, and maybe even some of the previous ones' families, which becomes an issue when you realize the various courts or trials that Jesus went to the night that he the night before he died. He went before Annas and Caiaphas. One was the current high priest, and one was the previous high priest. So the chief priests were in the Sanhedrin, the elders meaning lay leaders, and then the scribes. The scribes were the professional Old Testament teachers. They're the ones that have done the most studying. They're the ones that are going to say, well, the law says this. Elders would be more the practical, this is life today. And then, of course, the chief priest would be the head guy. So Jesus is directing his prediction about his death, saying that he's got to be rejected. He's going to suffer, and he's going to be rejected by the Sanhedrin. Then he says he must be killed, and then after 3 days he will rise again. Now stop just a second. You know, we go through this stuff so fast, and we make these people out to be made of cardboard or plastic or something. Just for a second, imagine what Peter and the boys are thinking. They've been wandering with Jesus for 3 years, 3 1/3 years, really. He has done amazing things in their sight. He has prophesied and discussed. He's brought to light Old Testament prophecies. He's indicated that he is the culmination of the Old Testament scriptures. He has done miracles having to do with people's lives, death, sickness. He has fed in a miraculous fashion. And he has led them to believe that he is indeed the Messiah. Just, you know, prior to this incident, he's making sure that they get, yep, it's me. I'm the one. Then, almost in the next breath, he says, by the way, the Sanhedrin, I got to tell you about them, they're going to, kill me, and I'm going to rise again 3 days later. What kind of a jolt would that have been had you been sitting around the campfire? First, the part about I'm going to be killed. Every hope that they have, every desire that is part of their understanding of the Old Testament scriptures has come to life in this man. Woo! It's here! And now he says, they're those guys, Sanhedrin, rulers, Jewish rulers, spiritual rulers, they're going to kill me. And I'm going to rise again on the third day. Okay. The rise again on the third day thing would have wigged me totally out. Well, what was that? I would have been camped on the first phrase. They're going to kill me. I would have. My nature would have stopped right there. I wouldn't have gotten to the part about you're going to rise in 3 days. I would have been, what? What are you talking about? How can that be? You're the one. You're the Messiah. We just went through this. You just told me I was a good guy, if you were Peter, for saying it. Now, look what happened. He spoke plainly about this. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Well, at least give him points for not shooting his mouth out in front of everybody. He did take him aside. Come on, that was funny.
Okay, it was.
It was funny. Again, we're still sitting there, all of us, around the campfire. Jesus just said he's going to get killed and rise again the third day. Peter pops up. Oh, whoa, you, me, over here. They go around the tree or somewhere. And Peter gets in his face. You know, he's going, what are you talking about? You can't, we're not letting them kill you. No way, Jose. Peter's missed the second part too. Right? Peter's camping on the first part of the phrase. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, turns around, looks at his disciples, then turns back around, I'm surmising it's a tree, I don't know. He rebukes Peter. We got a little rebuking going on here. No, they can't kill you. Yes, they can. No, I'm not going to let them. Yes, I must. No way, Jose. Shut up, Peter. I'm paraphrasing. That's essentially what happened. And then he goes on to say, get behind me, Satan. Ooh. This is just after thou art Peter, and upon this rock I'm going to build my church. He's now calling him the antithesis of what he just gave him by way of title and position and specialness, and saying, you're Satan. You're acting like him. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Now, again, I'm going to teach you all this, but before we get too far down on Peter, you don't think you have had times when you had in mind your own human issues, concerns, perspective, and did not have the concerns, issues, or perspectives of God? Last time you had a flat tire, what did you say? Why today? I mean, it's a stupid illustration, but immediately we go to... And then, of course, right up the scale, depending on how the horribleness of the tragedy might be, I don't know that anyone I know automatically always responds with, oh, God, what do you have in mind? Well, but, you know, even on the most trivial, we make it out to be life-shattering. And then go up the scale to something much more life-threatening or involving your children or someone you love or sickness or death. Dear friend called me last night, her father passed away. Those are not normally times when we go, oh, let me just stop right here. I need to show the perspective that God has on this. Our feet are made of clay. We live in this earth. Our hearts are bent to fear and frustration. You know, you don't have the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. I think I could put that on a 3x5 card, stick it on my mirror, in my car, on my desk, because that's often where I live. Now, bear that in mind as we go through the lesson. Okay, we know from Luke 22 that this strong glare when he turns around and comes back to Peter and starts rebuking him is a big deal, but it's not as big a deal as we might have thought before. We do know, though, when he calls him Satan, this is a big deal. He is in essence saying, look, the tempter is speaking in your voice. Do not let him influence you this way. That's essentially what he's saying. And Jesus is cutting him off at the pass. Turn to Matthew 16. We're going to bounce around a little bit today because one account has a little more than the other account. But in Matthew 16, in verse 23, you know, in verse 22, Peter took him aside, began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. In chapter 16, verse 23, Jesus turned to him and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Get out of my sight. Hush. Shut up. Now, again, before we nail Peter too much, Peter's strong heart and his definitive desire to serve Jesus and to protect him. He's a strong man. He's not a meek and mild guy. He's a fisherman. He's seen truth. He's following truth. He's living. He left his nets and he's following around this Jewish rabbi. He's committed. He's deep. Involved, and his heart is linked. He's the one that jumped out of the boat and was ready and did walk on water. He's exhibited great strength, but at the same time, he's off kilter. He's got the wrong perspective. He's standing in the wrong place. And Jesus is going to nail him. Perspective is a huge issue in life. Just a quick illustration. I have a neighbor in my new house, not on right or left, but above me. And apparently when our house went in, what little blue view the person had kind of got sliced a little bit. I wouldn't call it a real blue view, but it's a little blue view. And so now they're building a deck around the back of the house to take advantage of what view there is. And apparently right down between the two houses, our house and the house next door, there's kind of a little sliver thing. And the guy that put in all our plants and everything has been working the last few days, and so we went and bought all the plants this weekend. I think I bought half of America this weekend in plants. But anyway, plants and a tree, the dwarf magnolia. And we kind of put it, you know, along this line. So when he was up on his deck and looked down and saw the dwarf magnolia, which right now is about 4.5 feet tall, he wigged out. And Barbara happened to be walking around, and he called her up and had her come up on the deck, and the tree, and Barbara's so kind, which, by the way, she reminded me this morning that she's now listening to the podcast, so I can't say anything snooky about her. Sorry, Barb. Anyway, being the kind heart that she is, she's up there going, oh, yeah, oh, oh, bleeding with them. And she's a blue view lover herself. And so she comes down, and so she's chewing on me about we're planting this tree, and it's the only place, and whatever. Well, I did not respond the same way she responded. I responded, wait a minute, he's 15 feet high, da-da. What do you use as a horizon? He's got to have a clear perspective. So when she and I kind of went back and forth a little bit, because I was not being exceptionally kind. At any rate, fast forward to the next day, yesterday, I was home. The yard guy's doing his thing. This man from up on the top drove down and started engaging my lawn guy.
Oh, no.
Okay, so I stepped out. Executive Sherry stepped out. And so I walked over and, you know, hello, introduced myself again. And he started in about the tree. And I said, well, you know, a couple of things. Number one, I've asked the yard guy to go get a 12-foot stick and put a flag on the end of it and stick it right where that tree is supposed to go. Because now you can have a good perspective on how tall this tree could ever become. And that will help you see that my tree is not indeed going to block your view. And I went through my whole spiel.
Feet. Huh? You're not going to let it go 20 feet.
And well, by law, in that thing, you got to trim them at 12 is as high as they can go anyway. Anyway, my whole point was perspective on this guy. The only way I could get him to have perspective was pick a pole up and put a flag on it and make him get up on his deck and look and go, oh yeah, I can see over the flag. Perspective. The truth is, you and I don't do that with many things. We just leave our level, our angle, or where we are in a circumstance, and we react from where we are. If we took two steps to the left or two steps to the right, or we thought about something, if we increased or changed or varied our perspective, our reaction would be entirely different. I was having a conversation with someone over the weekend, and we were talking about reacting to things. And I said, well, let's say, for example, one of your kids fell really serious, something or another, in the hospital, had a surgery. Are you going to give one rip about that thing you just said? And the answer was no. They couldn't care less. Because perspective. What was more important then? Your child. You know, in a car wreck where someone is seriously hurt versus your car smoked up, if somebody was not seriously hurt, maybe you get all wigged out about the metal. I was looking at cars this weekend, and I laughed and said to the guy, boy, we're spending a lot of money for sweet-smelling plastic. And he didn't really appreciate my comment. And I said, and when it crumbles, that awful sound, you know, it's a lot of money for crumbling, you know, whatever. And he was just laughing at me. He was like, hey, lady, this is a premium, top-of-the-line something car. Well, perspective. Somebody's lying there hurt seriously. You couldn't care less about your car. You'd care about them. If you really got, if we all got in a bus and got a trip to heaven, and got 10 minutes, that's all we get. We look around, we see what it's like, get back in the bus and come back. Do you give a rip about dying anymore? No. It's perspective. We don't have perspective about heaven because other than Lazarus, nobody's gone and come back and told us about it. Right? It's perspective. In this particular case, that's exactly what Jesus says. Your perspective is off. You do not have in mind the concerns of God. But you're totally consumed with human concerns. So he says, get away from me. Get behind me. Get out of here. Get out of my face. The word he uses, the be quiet kind of comment, is the same word that he uses when he's silencing demons. In Mark 1, when Jesus turns around and tells demons to shut up, it's the same word he uses here for Peter. He wants them to get a better attitude, a different perspective. Shut up. You got it wrong. In fact, he goes one step further and he calls him a stumbling block. The word here, the word is scandalon, from which we get scandals. But the scandalon is the word here. You're a stumbling block. Well, in the Old Testament, that same word was used. When it was used like a some sort of an enticement to do something that would ruin the person in question. So, for example, in Leviticus 19, when he's laying out the law, he uses the same word and he says, don't become a stumbling block in front of the blind. So if you stuck a big block of wood out in front of a blind person walking by, you're purposefully conducting or you're purposefully enticing them to do something that's going to hurt them, stumble, a stumbling block. In Joshua 23, the word's used and it means a trap. And then in 1 Samuel 18, Saul's trying to decide whether to give his daughter Michal to David as a wife. And he goes, yeah, I'll give it to her. I'll give him her as a snare. Because then she can find out how he's hanging out with the Philistines and, you know, whatever. So the word snare or trap or stumbling is implied in here. He says, you are a stumbling block. You, Peter, a moment ago were the top. You had insightfulness like you can't believe. But all of a sudden, you've shifted perspective. And instead of seeing it from God's perspective, you're over here with all kinds of human concerns. You don't want me to die. I get it. But there is something bigger at work here. And the truth of the matter is, ladies, there's something bigger at work in all of our lives. You may be consumed in that stage of life with diapers and feeding and babies up early and whatever. Or you may be in the elementary stage consumed with lunches and, you know, driving around like a taxi cab driver. Or you may have older kids and you're consumed with rebellion and teenage nonsense and dating and what do we do about all that. Or you may be even older and have kids that are out and gone and you're wondering if they're ever going to make it. And in different states, and then, you know, kids are all gone and it's him. Do I really like him? I don't know. The rest of my life. Consumed with that. Or, oh, know him. Now what do we do for the rest of my life? Or whatever. The truth of the matter is, he's looking at Peter and saying, you're not on the team right now. You're causing people to stumble. You got the wrong perspective. When the same word is used in the New Testament, it really has more of a moral flavor. I want you to see it in Romans 14. It's the one place that I think shows it the best. Romans 14. Romans 14, verse 13. 14, 13. Paul's talking to the church at Rome, of course, and then he says in verse 13 of chapter 14, therefore, let us stop passing judgment on one another. Instead, make up your mind not to put a stumbling block or obstacle in the way of a brother or sister. So it's don't cause somebody to stumble. He's looking in Peter's face saying that attitude of not wanting to let God's will go forward is causing people to stumble. Stop it right now. You see, one of the commentators, I put it in your notes, it says, no wonder Jesus turned so sharply against Peter. He saw the satanic trap set for him in Peter's words. See, the idea is if God had stopped and done what Peter wanted, not allowed himself to go to the cross, would that have been a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah.
Hugely bad thing. And Peter didn't see that. All he saw was, I don't want my rabbi going to be killed by these Pharisaical dudes. But he didn't get it. He didn't see it. And neither do I. I get so consumed with me and mine and now. You know, our perspective, I've often used this illustration, is the difference here between the dot and the line. You know this perspective? Most of us see our world is that. That's today. That's me. It's mine. My family. My kids. My life. My health. There it is. This is how God sees it. I'm consumed with this. Now, today. My health. I'm seeing the surgeon today with my knee, so I'm consumed with health. This is it. Right here. What are you going to do for me? It hurts. It's painful. I don't like it. I don't want to use a cane. I want to be 16 again. You know, ta-da! I'm just using me as an illustration. We could use you. This is the perspective we're supposed to have. This is boxed up. This is boxed up in time, and space. The perspective is very one-sided. This. Goes on and on and on. This 70 plus years that we're all going to be given, maybe, is just a blip on that line. But we don't think about that. We cling to life and the quality of life as defined by us like it was all there was. That's Peter's crime here, is that he's focused on the dot and not on the line. Okay, so that's goober number one. Pretty big goober. Of which I think we all can relate. Or with which, or to which, or something. Goober number two. Mark 14. Go to Mark 14. This is the one that most of us spend a lot of time on when we're thinking about Peter, and I'm actually going to spend a whole lot less time than I did on the first one. But it needs to be taught nonetheless. This is the occasion of the Last Supper, specifically in chapter 14 of Mark, verse 12, on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So unleavened bread is one of the three festivals or feast days that every Jewish male was required to attend in Jerusalem. And actually, the Passover happens, and then the next day for 7 days is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it's an 8-day, join them together, two super-duper festivals or feasts. Laid out in Exodus 12, and you can read it for yourself, is the discussion of that three times a year, this being one of them, every Jewish male had to travel to Jerusalem to celebrate it. So this normally, this supper that they were going to take together as part of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread was a meal that, you know, various things were eaten, and I put them down on your notes, bread, wine, bitter herbs, sauce, and lamb. It was normally eaten standing up, and you can read that in Exodus 12, verse 11. So this feast day, or this festival, and this dinner, the sacrifice of the Passover, was something that normally would have been happening every year. Jesus is entering into this. I'm assuming that the 2 years before, they did similarly. So in chapter 14, on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" Now, it's also important to know that because not everybody lived in Jerusalem, it was the Jewish custom that they rented out rooms to people that were coming from out of town that needed a place to have a meal together. So it wasn't like Motel 6, we're going to sleep. It was like Motel 6, everybody comes to dinner here. And so they'd set up a room and have what they needed so that they could eat their Passover as a group. And so he sends his disciples into the city, and you know the story. They go and find the place for them. In verse 16, the disciples left, went into the city, found things just as Jesus had told them, so they prepared the Passover. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12 while they were reclining at the table. So in this particular case, they're laying down. Truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. Now, eating, laying down, I think you probably understood. If this was a table, they had like couches. So, you know, they're on this little couch leaning on one room, on one arm. And then the next guy would be little couch and he'd be leaning. So the two that were closest could have the easiest conversation, but right across, here's this guy leaning and that guy leaning. And I suppose if you were at the far end, you'd have a hard time to have a conversation. But close beside, you could whisper or say something and maybe everyone in the room wouldn't hear it. Okay, so he says to them in verse number 17, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." And they were saddened. And one by one, they said to him, "Surely, it ain't me. I mean, I would... Is it me? Shoot me now. Don't let me." Verse 20, he says, "It is one of the 12, one who dips bread into the bowl with me." So pretty close to him. "The Son of Man will go just as is written about him, but woe to the man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." So while they were eating, Jesus took the bread, and you know, he took the cup and said, "This is my body and this is my blood," and so on. Verse 26, when they had finished the dinner, they sung a hymn, and they went out to the Mount of Olives. Now, Mount of Olives is a place, I've mentioned it to you before, it's out the eastern side of Jerusalem. You go across the brook of the Kidron, and there are grapevines everywhere. And that's the place where in John 14, he goes, "I am the vine, you are the branches," and gives that great discourse. Well, he gets to the other side. to the Garden of Gethsemane. And the word Gethsemane means an oil press. This is the place where they bring the olives. Yeah, I said grapes, sorry. Olives, and press them and make the oil out of it. It was a piece of land, and if you go to Jerusalem, you can go right on that hillside. I don't know if it's the exact same garden or in the immediate vicinity, but it sure is similar. I went around counting rings in the trees that had been cut down to see if any of them were old enough to have been 2,000 years old. I couldn't find one. There was an old, gnarly, big, thick one, but they hadn't cut it yet, so I couldn't, you know, count the rings to see if it was old enough to be there. But it's the same location and the same whatever. It certainly gives you a good feel for this. So they're there. Verse 27, he says, "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written." Now pause. You will all fall away. Not Peter, just you, bud. You will all fall away. Now, the arrangement over there is 8 of the disciples apparently were told to sit at some distance. And then the inner 3, Peter, James, and John, were up closer, but still not exactly with him. They were told to watch and pray, and you know that they weren't able to do it. It came back 3 times, and they're snoring away. And so then it comes time for him to be arrested. So we'll go to verse 32. They went to a place called Gethsemane. Jesus' disciples hid here while I pray. Took Peter, James, and John along with him. He began to be greatly distressed and troubled, and you know the rest of that story. So when he gets down to verse 41, he's going to return the 3rd time. "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Not rise, let us go, let's get out of town, but rise, let's get this engaged. Let's get it started. This must happen. His perspective was the line. Okay, so just as he was speaking, verse 43, Judas, one of the 12, appears, was with him a crowd with, you know, swords and clubs and sympathy priests, the teachers of the law and the elders. "The betrayer had arranged a signal. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him, lead him away under guard." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near, guess who? Peter, drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Now, I've heard people who really get on Peter. Really? The man who you have said in other places, you know, I will die for you, is suddenly arrested and falsely, and it's all a hoax, and he knows it. And wouldn't you, if you were in his shoes, want to protect? I mean, I don't know about the knife in the ear thing, but I would have been, you know, engaged in some form or fashion. No, you're not taking him. He just whipped off his ear. Good strike for those of us that like the military. But anyway, Jesus said, "Wait a minute, a perspective here. Am I leading a rebellion? That you've come out with swords and clubs to capture me. Every day I was with you in the temple courts. You didn't arrest me, but the scriptures must be fulfilled. I see the line." Then everyone deserted him and fled. Great. Great. Then everyone deserted him and fled. Again, we get on Peter for his denial, and he is going to deny, and you know the story. He does it 3 times. Jesus told him it was going to happen 3 times. It happens 3 times. The cock crows. It is clear in all of the accounts of the Gospels that, you know, there are 3 denials. The first 2, he denies even identifying with Jesus. And then the last time, he denies Jesus is Jesus. And he rightfully does wrong and should get slapped for it. But where's everybody else? It took off. At least he hung around. At least he engaged. Inappropriately in some cases, but he engaged. In verse 66, while Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. A little bitty girl, couldn't bother him if she wanted to. When she saw Peter warming himself, he's the one that hung around, she looked close at him and said, "Oh, yeah, you're one of those Nazarene dudes." But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about." And then he went out into the entryway, went further out. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, "Yeah, that guy over there, he is one of them." And then he denied it again. A little while later, those standing near to Peter said, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." And he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Immediately the rooster crowed the 2nd time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him before the rooster crows thrice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and he wept. Now, a side note here that I didn't want to consume myself in teaching today is, as you look at the three accounts in the Gospels about the denials, they're slightly different, but they're slightly different because each writer had a different perspective. So in your notes I said, you know, in Matthew and Mark, they list the three denials, before the servant girl, before another girl, and before bystanders. Luke lists three, before a servant girl apparently near the fire, before another person, place not specified, and before yet a third person still in the courtyard. Then the three denials recorded in John are before a servant girl, before some people, and before one of the high priests. So they're not in opposition to each other, the accounts. It's just each of the writers is giving you a slightly different look at the denials. The writer is treating the sequence of those trials differently. The point is that the oath that Peter uses is not cursing. It's more of like using foul language. It's like he's calling on himself a curse if he's lying. This is exactly what Jesus told him not to do in Matthew 5. You know, when he said, let your yea be yea, your nay be yea, be nay. He was just saying, you don't need this, you know, and curse me if I whatever. It's an unnecessary, inappropriate focus. Just tell the truth. But he uses that and calls down fire on himself if he was lying. Of course he was lying. He burst into tears. The expression there in Greek, he burst into tears, or he thought about it and then he wept, or another one said, essentially, he threw himself on the ground. This is not, he's standing there and it dawns on him, oh, that was wrong, and a tear trickled down his face. This is that abject understanding, I did serious wrong. And he starts wailing at his failure. What's the point of the lesson today? I think the point of the lesson is that Peter was incredibly frustrated that Jesus wasn't doing what he thought he should do. Difficult situation, pending arrest, bad guys coming, they got guns, they didn't have guns, they got knives, we should act, we should protect, we should whisk him away, don't let him get him. Why isn't God doing what I think he should do in this circumstance? And then he reacts. And I don't think that's so terribly different than me or you. I think we find ourselves in a set of circumstances. We think God should react or provide or do in a certain way. And when he doesn't, we react. I think the truth is we need to learn the same lesson that Peter had to learn. And Job learned it in Job 2. I want you to look at Job 2 as just a final thought. In Job chapter 2, it's not in your notes, but I thought of it this morning. It's just an interesting perspective on this. You know the story of Job. His family's wiped out. His life is wiped out, let's say. And in Job chapter 2 in verse number 10, in verse 9, his lovely wife, encouraging him in his spiritual life, says, are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die. But then he responds, you are talking like a foolish woman. And here's the key question. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? How dare we look at a sovereign Lord and say, great, I'll take that. No thanks, not interested in that. Very human, very normal, in quotes, would be very unnormal if the doctor called with the, ooh, we got a C here, the big C, if you went, oh, really? Great, just bought a new car too. They would put you in the loony bin. But note the spiritual maturity, the perspective that Job captures with that question. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Perspective. Peter, I think, got it. Because in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 and 13, listen to what he says. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come on you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you, like your Savior being arrested and predicting he will die. But rejoice inasmuch as you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. When you finally get a peek at the line, you'll get it. Isn't that a great lesson for us? Mm-hmm. Let's pray. Lord, there is so much in Peter, in his life, even in his two biggest moments of failure, that is so easy to identify. I love it when you bless me. I love it when you bless the people around me. I love it when things are going well and I have abundance. I love it when there's no pain and no suffering in those that I love. I love it when life is rolling by. And I object at the first sign of a hiccup. I am so consumed with a poor perspective, it's not funny. So I pray you'd help me and others to use our minds and our hearts and our spiritual maturity as we grow to be more like you, to be able to accept the good and the not so good, to be able to recognize that your death was something that had to happen, or Peter was in a whale of hurt. Thank you for this great story that we can read and relate to, and help us to consider it all joy when the not so good stuff comes. Thank you for ignoring Peter and going to the cross. In Jesus' name.